no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a
off. He's listening to interview.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I had a high hope for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What is happening, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. This is episode 90. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. It is B&W Championship Week. The PGA Tour is coming back to the region, coming back to Caves Valley for the first time in 4 years. It's the second stage of the FedEx Cup playoffs. And, you know, it's not exactly the Beltway, but just northwest of Baltimore. It's within striking distance. I'm going to be up there at Caves Valley at least 3 days during the week this week. So if you see me run around taking pictures or just, you know, strolling with a hot dog or beer in my hand, come say what's up, please do. I'll be running around, but excited to go see the new caves. As we talk about in today's podcast, Caves Valley went under a renovation, particularly around the green complexes, just a couple of years ago in 2023. But certainly these are all new greens since the last time the BMW Championship was here. So in kind of concert with the tournament, got a guest on that I've been wanting to have for a long time, who's the director of instruction, longtime director of instruction at Caves Valley Golf Club, Mr. Bernie Najjar, who is a decorated teacher, top 50 Golf Digest teacher, Golf Magazine top 100, and has won the Mid-Atlantic PGA Teacher of the Year 4 times. So he's got serious credentials, and it's good to kind of just let him talk about some of the things that make golfers better and what people can work on and what he looks for in new students and in the swing. But he also can share a lot of insight on this upcoming week with the BMW Championship at Caves. So excited to chat with Bernie. If you're just listening to this for the first time, make sure you go to beltwaygolfer.com, sign up for our free monthly newsletter. It's all about golf in the Mid-Atlantic, focusing on the nation's capital region around the Beltway. Give us a follow on social media, particularly on Instagram. But that's about it. Stay tuned. We've got some more stuff in the works. But for right now, episode 90, we're getting up there. All right, Mr. Bernie Najjar, how are you, sir?
Doing great. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Great to meet you. I appreciate you taking some time to join the podcast. I understand, are you at home right now, or are you in the Performance Center at Caves Valley?
Made my way home after a long day at Caves, but we're excited to host the BMW Championship next week. And my office is turning into a rural center and a weather station. So I'll be teaching from my house in Bethesda for the next couple of weeks, but I'll be up there a good bit.
Oh, wow. So they essentially totally kick you out of the Performance Center, so you can't do lessons there at all.
Pretty much that's the case, yeah. We were able to go through tomorrow, but I wrap things up today just because it's getting pretty squeezed down there. We have the entire Performance Center set up for the rules officials and whoever's doing their weather station stuff, and the range tee's got right now limited space, and they're putting in a pretty big net to keep the guys from flying balls into the building from up top. But long story short, tournament's around the corner. It's going to be a great week for Caves and for Maryland.
Absolutely. I want to talk a bunch about Caves Valley and the tournament before we get into your career and your books and some other things. But for folks that have not been to Caves, I was up there in 2021 for the BMW Championship, and I was lucky enough to play during media day just a month or so ago. But for folks that'll be up there for the first time or aren't aware, orient folks as to where your performance center is, like in relation to the main clubhouse or the first and 18th hole.
Sure. So since we've hosted the BMW Championship, we've reversed the original starting hole from the number one we had for many years is now number 10. And we did that during the BMW Championship, and we did a pretty significant course renovation over the last few years. New grass, right. New greens, new contours that will challenge the players. And the routing we are now using is the same one from the BMW Championship in 21. So what used to be the first hole that goes into the valley is now the 10th hole, and the performance center is to the left of the 10th hole. Or if you're watching number 11, which is a short par four that you usually can see off the driveway when you pull in on the right side, that's also near our building. So we are very close to the 10th and 11th hole. And then if you're watching the players hit balls at the range, at the bottom of the range on the other side, they'll see a building which is going to be protected by a net. And that is the performance center.
Got it. I haven't been up there yet, obviously, since they've added the ropes and everything and seen the crowds. Mm-hmm. We'll see that until next week. But if memory serves from 2021, that was kind of a popular area, kind of on the higher side of number 11 coming into 10, where there was that was a heavily trafficked area for people to watch, especially number 11, since you're kind of at a little bit of a higher vantage point, and you're kind of looking down. If they're going to do the same entrance, the entrance to the entire tournament was right there on the other side of 11. So it was a beautiful spot to kind of see folks kind of tee off and go for that green, which is a relatively short par four.
Yes. Number 11 is about three, depends where they put the tee, but we'll say it's about 330-ish from the back tee. They could stretch it to 345, depending on which tee box. We do have another tee box, just depending on how far back they go. But I think what they're going to do is make it fun for the spectators. I noticed they did a little trimming on some of the branches on the right side of the box, which we have two tee boxes. One is actually right near my performance center. The fans won't have access to stand by that tee, but you can certainly see them hit out of there. And you'll see also another tee box that's down in the little area off to the side. That's got a nice little chute for you to hit shots out of. And looks like they're giving them some incentive to go for it, because before they did that little bit of trimming, you'd have to hit a pretty big cut as a right-handed player. Or if you're a lefty, you could hit a nice big draw there. But we'll see. It should be an exciting hole to watch. And the green now has some consequences. If you don't execute the shot correctly, it's shaved down pretty nicely. Lots of shots coming in that are a little bit on the right side of the green will scurry on down to the water. So there's a little risk reward. I think you'll see a lot of players, if they are going for it, they're definitely going to hit it long left or short left, but it won't be heading into that little throat right in front of the green. They're going to miss over there. But then they have a pretty delicate, fast greens running. The green complex there has got a lot of slope in it. So, yeah, these are the best in the world, top 50 on tour. They have all the shots. So, of course, they'll see what they can do from that position. But if they feel like they have a good chance and it's worth the risk, they'll take a go. If not, certainly, they'll lay back and play a wedge shot in, which they normally hit inside 9 feet. So, should be a lot of birdies on number 11.
Yeah, well, on my media day round, I actually had a really good round for the way I normally shoot. I'm a 10 handicap, not a great golfer. I'm not a long golfer either. So on the 11, you know, hit it short left of that bunker on the left. Thought I had a great approach, hit it, the safe spot of the green, but it rolled just off the back. So I had a tricky chip to what you just described, back to kind of a tucked right pin, and was lucky that it rolled off the green coming back. It did not go in the water, but I think I still managed to double. But that's going to be a fun hole to watch, no doubt. So on the course, so you've been the director of instruction at Caves Valley for how many years now?
I'm in my 14th season. So
14th season. So you've been there for quite a while. And 2012. Okay. I'm guessing, as the director of instruction, I've certainly seen a lot of your social media views. You're out there with some of your students. You've played the course a million times, and so you know the course backwards and forwards. We did have some caddies that on media day that were telling us a bit about how different and how the greens since 2021 in this recent renovation are really just totally new complexes. How can you talk a little bit about how different the greens and the complexes and the bunkering is since that renovation, and for folks that were there in 2021, how different it'll be?
Yeah, it's definitely brand new green complexes. There's new grass on them. So our agronomy is better than it's ever been. And that's a big tribute to our superintendent, Kyle Steidel. We've always had great superintendents. So we've always had a very top-notch golf course from a condition standpoint. And with today's technology, the precision air allows us to heat and cool the greens, which is pretty wild to think of. You basically have an HVAC system under the greens.
Was there already precision air, or was that part of what the renovation? Okay. So that was part of the renovation.
And, you know, with technology, and if you look at the game of golf and the courses that are being renovated today, there's not a lot of new builds, but when you get the opportunity to go in there and clean up the structure that is so vital for a healthy green, you know, we're talking drainage. We're also making sure all the areas around the green divert water properly. Okay. So if drainage on, if you don't have good drainage on the green, then you have to put big slopes in, and they usually are what we call planar greens, which are a predominant slope from a high to a low. What makes putting more complicated and what will challenge the players this time around, there's a lot of what we call double break putts and even putts that, you know, some might say, oh, they break even more than twice. Multi-planar putts happen when the slopes are changing, but they're subtle little waves through the green, and you'll see that in a lot of golf courses now. Because they've improved the agronomy so much, they can put flatter sections that tie into steeper sections. So on the tour, a lot of hole locations are going to be just like they always are. Every week on tour, they'll put them 3-4 off the side, usually 1 or 2 paces away from a big slope. So it rewards the great ball striker for when they hit a nice shot. If you're playing a conservative shot, you're really going to have to work hard to roll it up there and tap in. I mean, I think you're going to see these are the best players in the world. They're the most precise. Sure. They're great putters. And obviously the one that wins next week will have put it together from tee to green in all those areas. But you'll see some players out there struggling a little more on the greens because they're more complex reads than before. If you take some risk and you hit the wrong tier, you're going to maybe miss the green down into a collection area, and now your short game is going to be tested. So I think our green complexes, especially for the everyday player at Caves, are significantly tougher. I know if you ask me for my game, it's 4 shots tougher.
Really? Okay.
And I say that, you know, I don't play a ton of golf, and my craft is, you know, I help people with their games, but to a fault, I don't play enough golf. But I can tell you it plays 2 to 4 shots tougher for me. And I think if you ask the majority of our members, they'd tell you the same thing. And that doesn't mean the tour guys are going to experience that. But sure. I think it's a couple shots tougher for sure than when they saw it last time. Plus, knock on wood, we're going to have some drier conditions leading up, which will lead to firmer fairways, firmer greens, and then these new hole location options. We've got more options for them to set the course up. That's not up to us. That's up to the PGA Tour. But sure. You know, I think we're going to be a par 70 this time around. And I would just say they're still going to shoot low. They're the best in the world. And unless you have crazy wind conditions and, you know, U.S. Open rough, it's hard to keep these guys from shooting 18 under par. What I can tell you is they're going to have to work a little bit harder this time to do it because the challenge is going to be greater in a lot of areas than the last time they were here.
Sure. And it's playing as a par 70. I believe the second hole is playing as a par 4 for the BMW. Is that right?
That's correct.
Whereas I think for members, is that a par 5? I think that for us that they played that as a par 5. I know that was it was a beast of a hole. And so I think I did actually birdie that, but that was my lone birdie, but that would, unfortunately, that'd be a par if I was.
Well, but you know, you're not playing the PGA Tour.
That's exactly right.
The truth of the matter is for those guys, and you know, the tour is going to set it up. They might not have the tee all the way back as if it's a 5, but
sure,
it's not really a proper par 5 for today's PGA Tour player.
Right.
It doesn't have enough length, but the unique thing about Caves Valley is we have a golf course where members can bring guests to play and everybody can play the golf course.
Yeah.
Now they can experience from tee to green, plenty of challenge, but they can finish holes where, you know, a lot of places they might go, they can't really play a PGA Tour golf course and experience all 18 holes because they're in their pocket, you know, 2/3 of the time. So we have a fun golf course to play. It plays tougher. And like I said, for myself and most, it's 2 to 4 shots tougher. And it's a lot more interesting to me in that these new hole locations can really change the shot you need to play into them. And I think the tour is going to love it, love the improvements, and you'll see some great shot making. You know, last time it was soft, they were just throwing darts. You're going to see some shots into different sections of the green where they can play some slope and work the ball into a hole location or maybe play away from them. But it's a different golf course for sure.
Certainly. Is there one green or one hole that you would point out that you see a larger difference than maybe others that could trip some of these guys up?
These are the best in the world. I don't think you're going to trip tour players up too much. They are so good. You know, I'm blessed. I get to watch in person, sometimes inside the ropes with a few guys I coach. But, you know, what I can tell you is our new fifth hole, it's a brand new green complex. A lot of folks might not make it out to the front nine in that area, but I encourage you to, because first of all, it's beautiful. Secondly, that's a super dicey short par 4. And that one could throw a few people off. I would still tell you again, these are the best players in the world. They're so good with their wedges. But the everyday golfer standing there trying to hit a 70 to 120 yard shot to a small green where you have to land within 3 yards of your number, that's right. Really hard. And even and
it's a shallow green, right? I mean, it's small, yeah. But not deep at all.
Yeah. So you'll see some hole locations where, again, somebody's going to slip up and make a little mess there, but these are the best in the world. So I don't think that's going to be too much of what happens. I think you'll see some really interesting shots into some of the holes that have, you know, it's not like you're going to stand there and go, wow, the 13th hole looks brand new because it's going to look like the same par 3, but that green is totally different. And so you're going to have some difficult, we're going to say 2 putts, even for the best in the world, where they got to cover a couple tiers to get up to the hole location, unless they get it in that exact area. But sometimes even the best in the world aren't going to shoot at the pin, and they're going to leave themselves 25 to 40 feet, get out of there. And those are some green complexes that, again, you're going to see some interesting putting challenges for the best in the world. And then, you know, obviously you're going to see the new first hole. If you're by the first tee, that's a brand new golf hole. It's spectacular. It's 100 yards longer than what we had last time. It's a great walk down to the green. Green runs away from the front. So shots into that green need to be precise. But again, these guys all bomb it and they'll have short irons in, but there's some really nice hole locations they can challenge the players with, and it'll be fun for people to see those improvements.
I totally agree when you say you hope that spectators get out to that area of the course, like by the fifth hole you're saying, but that back corner, like beyond the fourth green, looking back at the property is just a stunning view. And that whole kind of section of, obviously, the beautiful par 3 third that, you know, there was got, you know, more flowers than just about any golf hole in America. And then yes, the beautiful par 5, and then coming back with a short par 4. That corner is just a spectacular viewing corner. And I think not a lot of folks will probably make it out there. Probably a great spot to watch golf. Going back to 2021 and maybe looking forward to this week as the director of instruction, you know, what are you doing this week? Are you going out every day? Do you have any kind of role? Or are you just, you mentioned you're giving lessons at your home, but how many days will you be out at Kays Valley during the BMW, if at all?
It's a great question. I'll probably be out there on Tuesday and Wednesday. Wednesday for sure. Definitely Tuesday for some of the day. And when I go out there, you know, my goal is to do 3 things. 1, be helpful if I can. So if anybody on our team needs me to help out with anything, I'm there. I'll definitely spend a little time at the range and watch some of the best in the world hit some balls. And then I would probably slide out to the golf course. I think practice rounds are some of the best viewing experiences for seeing what they do. And I'll be curious to watch how they they play some shots into some of the holes and what short game shots they look like they're working on to get ready. It's always good to see the best doing their thing. I love studying success and the little stuff, seeing their trajectory, watching how their apex on their shots takes place. You know, the game's changed a lot. The ball's changed a lot. Everybody hits it for the most part really far, but just seeing that flight in person, it's always helpful. And then sliding by and watching what they're doing at the putting green and so forth. So I'm always learning, try to be a sponge. And I've got friends that coach a number of players out there, so I'm sure I'll spend a little time with them. And beyond that, it'd be nice to see our members and their guests and see some friends I typically run into there that will be out for the tournament.
Sure.
And we have a really cool, I'm doing a clinic for the first tee on Wednesday with Dennis Satisher. Dennis and I are going to do something for the first tee on the putting green up by the range. So we'll do something there. And we got a couple other events. So it'll be a fun week. And I'll probably be back on Saturday, maybe Sunday. It's hard to go up every day, to be honest. But I'm happy to do whatever makes sense. And it's always fun to have the best in the world on property.
Sure. Do you get an opportunity to see the pros much? Like since they were here in 2021, have you been to many tour events?
So I coached some players that played in tour events. So I was at the U.S. Open this year with one of my students who made the cut, and I was out there for a good bit of the week. And, you know, same kind of thing where you're out there and, you know, when you're working at a tournament as a coach, you know, your eyes are on your player. But there are times where your player's in the locker room or doing cold plunge or working out, and you might not be with them every step of the way. And you have access inside the ropes to see and experience some things that most people don't get a chance to. So for me, that's just so valuable. And, you know, whenever you see a course set up by the PGA Tour, take note of it because you'll learn something, you know, whether it's the hole locations, positioning, whatever it might be, because that's all part of helping other players and realizing degrees of difficulty and, you know, looking at shots and thinking, okay, let me just think what they might do here and then watch what they do. And that's pretty neat to do. And again, being the sponge, paying attention to stuff. But the most important thing is, you know, you go out there and be open to learning, you know, be someone that walks out of there with some takeaways because we're always learning. And, you know, the best in the world, they're doing stuff sometimes. Like in 21, I got a chance to spend some time at the range with Bryson DeChambeau, and that was really cool. And at the time, he was doing some long drive training and very curious to ask me about Kyle Berkshire, who I coach. And we had a nice 90-minute range session, you know. And when I say that, I wasn't planning on being there with him for 90 minutes, but he couldn't be nicer, very inquisitive about some things that Kyle does and wanted to tell me some suggestions for Kyle to help him with his regular golf. And he went through the bag, was taking me through all kinds of shots. It was great. I mean, I got the wonderful demonstration by, you know, the guy who finishes runner up that week that, I mean, where else do you get that? So I was very, very fortunate. And to watch him hit the ball on a tee that I'm familiar with and just watch his flight and just see what he was doing to play different shots and just watching how he went through the bag was invaluable.
I'm sure you're a top 50 instructor, one of the best in the game that teaches golf. Watching someone like Bryson, especially like Bryson is a range rat, a well-known range rat. You know, that I imagine you can see things that the tour players are doing in their warmups, particularly whether it's on the range or on the putting green, that you can say, hey, and take some of that you can apply to your lessons with your students.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're always going to pick stuff up. I got to walk last time, 9 holes, I walked with Xander Schauffele, Patrick Cantlay, Charlie Hoffman, and Kevin Kisner.
That's a nice bunch.
And so a good friend of mine caddied for Charlie for 10 years, and one of his good friends is a good friend of mine, and we met up and walked inside the ropes with them. They were great. And, you know, again, you don't know who's going to win or who's going to play well, but you get an inclination of it when you see these players. But it was cool to watch them play, and they were having a little match, but they started a little slow, and you could just see their focus get better and better. But, you know, one of the coolest things I saw on number three, the downhill par three that you're referring to, is Patrick Cantlay just set up to hit a five iron there and literally did a full stop top of his swing, swung down and hit it to about 15 feet. And the first couple of holes, he wasn't hitting it particularly well. He had a couple awkward misses for him. And he literally stopped at the top of his swing for the next five holes and then stopped doing it. And, you know, the rest is history. He went out and won the tournament, but he was tuning his swing on the course, and it was cool to watch.
Wow.
What a tremendous long iron player he is. And obviously he putted great, but if you get a chance, take a look at Patrick hitting long irons. I mean, they're all really good at hitting long irons, but there aren't too many that I've seen hit long irons that well. Patrick, Adam Scott, absolutely incredible. Xander, for his size, hits it super far. And what a craftsman around the greens. Just amazing to watch. Charlie Hoffman won't be there, neither will Kisner, but great players. And anytime you get to see those guys, they're pretty special to watch.
That sounds like a heck of a group. Back to your chat with Bryson for a second, though. It was fairly well documented and publicized, the Bryson and Kyle's kind of friendship there for a while, as Bryson was really getting into the long drives, even entered a handful of world long drive competitions, I believe. Did that kind of emanate from that conversation on the range when he's pulling your ox? I feel like 2021 was probably around the time that started, was it not?
Well, they were spending some time together before that, especially during that COVID deal.
Oh, okay. You know, that's kind of what it, right.
During
COVID,
there was a lot of craziness going on in golf, and Bryson did, you know, a good bit of training with Kyle. And, you know, the best way to put it, Bryson's a curious guy, loves to work out, loves to take every piece of what he's trying to do and understand it better. And he's a special person, works his butt off. He's incredibly gifted, but it's not just being born with it. He works really hard. So I would say, you know, at that point in time, obviously he didn't have the same social presence and feel good situation with the golf world. You know, people were kind of rooting against him.
Yeah.
If you look at where he was there and where he is now, it's just incredible. But I got to say, he couldn't have been nicer to me and our staff. He was great. So I was rooting for him. And Patrick, I mean, they just played so well.
So the last thing on the 2021, so the final score, I had to go back and check this. I forget, and you mentioned, you alluded to it, you know, thinking or hoping that this week we get some drier conditions. I had forgotten it got a little damp last time. It's been 4 years. And the scores that Bryson and Patrick tied with is minus 27. Is there a number that you think, you know, when members are kind of chatting at the range on what they think or hope that winning score will be this time around?
Well, I can't speak for our membership because some of the people might prefer one side of it versus the other. Right. But what I can tell you is the PGA Tour, they control the course setup.
Sure.
And if they want the guys to make birdies, then the course will be set up for them to make birdies. If they want them to experience a little turmoil, they can do that as well. But it'll be a great show. And what I will say again, you got the best 50 in the world. Week in, week out, they average about 18 under par on the PGA Tour. If you look statistically, somewhere around that number, 16 to 18 under.
Right.
But it depends on the wind. It depends on where they put the hole locations. And, you know, if they shoot 20 under and we have fun watching it, or 25 under or 16 under, to me, it doesn't matter. I want to see a great show. I'd love to see another stretch.
And that was a great show.
Golf, you know, coming down where we just don't know who's going to win. I think that would be so cool to see that coming down the stretch on Sunday, 16, 17, 18, you couldn't pick a better set of holes to wrap the tournament up on. And if we have sudden death, what a great walk there as well. So I'm going to say 20 under.
Okay. There we go. I got a number out of you. That sounds good. So you had mentioned, I want to talk about your career a bit. You mentioned you've been at Kays Valley for 14 years. So that puts us back, you said 2012 How long ago did you start coaching golf?
Pretty much when I got out of college in 94. May of 94, I started my first job at the Suburban Club, which is also in Baltimore, Maryland. And I was lucky enough to work there. Had a great schedule as an assistant pro. I got to work one side of the day in the shop and teach the other side. And, you know, from there, I got a chance to spend time with a lot of different golfers, you know, from low handicaps to brand new golfers. So right out of the gates, I got a chance to experience all sides of the game. And I still do today. I still work with players of all abilities and ages. And I got hired in, I'll just say 95, to teach a player. Father hired me to teach his son after school. And I had a unique 7-month project down in Florida. And then I came back and taught in Virginia and also in the Bethesda area for about 5 months. And from there, I started working at Woodhome Country Club, where I was teaching there for, I was in my 17th year when I got recruited to go to Capes. So I haven't moved around much, but I've been, you know, doing what I love to do and trying to get better at it each day. So been very fortunate.
So a couple of your students, I've had one of your students on the podcast who it was a great story, Mr. Brian Kim. He joined, I'm trying to remember, I think it was right before he went down to Pinehurst. He had just won the U.S. Junior. Or yeah, I guess he had won it was a while after he won the U.S. Junior, but it was in the lead up to the U.S. Open at Pinehurst where he played. But I believe he was he 18? Or 17 or 18 when he won the U.S. Junior and qualified for the U.S. Open. But he told me he only started playing golf when he was 11, which I find remarkable.
Yeah. Well, you know, golf is it's an interesting game. Not everybody starts before becoming teenagers. But, you know, even if you're starting at 10, 11, 12, if you played other sports, a lot of the movements we do in golf are similar to other sports. So you can tap into those, we'll call them functional movement skills, right? And then you might see kids that start real early, but they're not learning those athletic skills, and that might actually work against them. So Greg Norman, from what I understand, really didn't start golf until he was 16, 17 years old. Really? And he was scratched within a year. Yeah. Larry Nelson, I think, didn't start till he was maybe even 19 or 20. I mean, there's some crazy stories about players that didn't start early. Now, Tiger had a club in his hand at a very young age, but not everybody's going to start early and love the game. They might find the game early at the wrong time and phase out of it. But, you know, I can tell you, I played a lot of tennis growing up before golf. I played other sports, but I stumbled into golf. No one played golf in my family. And once I got a taste of it around seventh grade, it's when I first got exposed to it. And I was thinking, geez, what can I do to get decent enough to make my high school team? And, you know, if you find the love and passion for it, you're going to work your butt off. And Brian's a guy that he's got a great work ethic and beautiful golf swing. But he was a very, very competitive swimmer. And look, he's an athletic guy as well. But the discipline you learn from competing in other sports and just being someone who's skillful like he is and works hard, it's no mistake he is where he is today.
Certainly. That's interesting. So for so long, I've kind of thought about golf in the same vein as, like, you know, some of these balanced sports like surfing or skiing, only in the fact that I always, you know, if you started when you were 3 or 4 years old, you know, you'd have such an easier time with it because these movements are muscle memory. And I always kind of thought about that with golf. And I didn't know that about Greg Norman. And that's why I was kind of so blown away by Brian, the fact that he went from not picking up a club to winning the U.S. Junior in 6 years and playing in the U.S. Open. But that's interesting what you say about not learning poor muscle memory or kind of starting fresh just with kind of an athletic skill set.
You know, throwing, catching, jumping, skipping, if you can't do those things as a kid and then you're asked to swing a golf club that requires those skills, you're going to be in trouble. You're just going to probably chop at the ball. So to me, you know, especially watching a lot of kids now, we're lucky we got the U.S. Kids Clubs. They make these really nice light golf clubs for the juniors. Ping's doing a great job with it as well. Some of the other companies are starting to do it. that's huge, because if you give a junior golfer a really heavy club that you don't realize is heavy, you took an old set, you cut them down thinking, hey, this will be good for my son or daughter. You just gave them something too heavy and stiff. And so they don't really feel the club. They don't really feel the shaft. And that's a real disadvantage to me when you first start golfing. So the equipment's better. The coaching's better than ever. Most of the people out there running junior programs are aware of the things I just mentioned. So you might see what looks like an untraditional golf lesson work very well, where, you know, maybe they're playing t-ball in the golf lesson. Maybe they're throwing and catching. I mean, we got to make these kids athletic so that they can play this sport correctly, you know. So just chopping at the ball doesn't do anything except, you know, burn calories. But my goal is whoever's in front of you, whether they're 4 years old, 8 years old, 12 years old, you're making sure the sequence is right. And then that, you know, so-called muscle memory over time can really work for them and not against them. It's a bummer when you see a kid working really hard and unfortunately their sequence is wrong and now you got to undo a bunch of things. But nothing like working with someone and building a golf swing and just a love of the game over time. That's super cool.
Sure. Well, while we're on it, I'm going to ask a selfish question, because when you're talking about body sequencing, and this actually has come up a lot, because I've got a kid who I've got a 9-year-old who really enjoys golf, but he loves baseball a little bit more. And so there's I've had a lot of conversations recently about the similarities and differences between the golf swing and the baseball swing. And tell me if I'm way off here, because a lot of those conversations end up really with the sequencing, especially of the lower body kind of starting the swing and bringing into the hips is very similar to the golf swing, whereas maybe the arms and wrists are quite different animal entirely. But that sequencing, those two things can be very similar. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, they certainly are. I mean, you're hitting a baseball in a different plane than a golf ball. So that's going to change your hitting mechanics. And again, the better athletes figure it out sooner. But, you know, I've worked with some, I'm going to keep them nameless, right? We'll just say maybe they were pro baseball players that struggle with the golf hitting plane until they get the aha moment that they're different. And then they look at you and they go, are you kidding me? And then I say, no, I'm not kidding you. Here, watch. And, you know, so once they understand the hitting zone, it's the light bulb goes off, you know? I mean, it's just... So hitting planes in all sports, whether you play tennis, whether you're a golfer, pickleball, ping pong, whatever, you gotta learn where you're gonna meet the ball. And, you know, baseball players, they have their arms up, they're standing pretty tall, and if you do that with a golf swing, you'll probably be a chop slicer. And almost everybody coming into golf from baseball, they swipe across the ball. And they're strong, they got a lot of speed. So if you understand how to move that player from that upright position and get their arms in the right plane and their body moving correctly, and you show them, hey, this is the hitting plane, it's not that bad.
Right.
But you got to catch them early, because if they're out golfing like that, they're going to hate golf. They're going to slice like crazy. So most of the time, once you get in the concept of the plane, and they can release a bat with a lot of speed, they become really good golfers. Hockey players are usually the easiest to teach.
Why do you think that is? Because that plane is already so much lower.
Yeah, the puck's at the ground, you know.
Right, exactly. So it's the same.
I say usually there are issues with hockey players too, but some of the best hitters you'll see, they have a hockey background.
Sure. No, that comment about chopping at the ball steep and swinging across it and slicing it, that hit close to home, because that's what my 9-year-old and I are. We just had some conversations about that on the course a couple of days ago.
Yeah. So if you put him in a like a T-ball station, that's much more, it'd be like the ball's way above your feet, and get him to hit the golf ball or a tennis ball, whatever, without hitting the cone or whatever's holding the ball up, that could teach him some horizontal plane release mechanics, right?
Sure. But
because in baseball, because your arms are up and you're chopping down to the hitting zone, that same move in golf is just pop up, slice, pull, chunk.
Yeah.
All right. And so he just needs to reorient his awareness of that.
Sure. Moving on to, you know, you mentioned kind of the generating power in the golf swing, and likely your most famous or well-known student or most publicized, certainly on your social media, and you had mentioned Marty a couple of times, Mr. Kyle Berkshire. You started working with him at what age? It was fairly young, right?
Yeah, he's about 10, 2009-ish. I mean, I have video back at least to 2009. He might have been there before then, but yeah, we'll say 2009. Yeah.
And describe his golf game as a 10-year-old.
So Kyle, you know, he came in and his father brought him in for his first lesson and kind of told me, hey, look, he doesn't really take lessons. He kind of does his thing naturally. Or, you know, we've tried a few here and there, but he wasn't really connecting with the coach. Let's see what happens. And, you know, fortunately for me, we've been doing this a long time, but he's such a good athlete and he could have been a pro baseball player, in my opinion. His brother was an awesome baseball player, but I think Kyle, you know, he's just got remarkable hand eye. Now, he's a big man, and if you saw him as a junior back then, he was not a big kid. He grew late. And so to keep up with the other kids, he was, you know, definitely doing what we would call overspeed training without realizing it. And he had some unique qualities in his swing of a power hitter, strong grip, definitely used a ton of ground forces, pushing off the ground. And he did some unique things in his golf swing, but he's also double jointed. I mean, there's stuff with his body that's very unique. And so I remember, you know, his dad asking me, you know, how come you haven't changed his grip? This is year into it. Uh-huh. And I said, well, I don't want him to hit it right. Because, you know, his dad was asking me, you're letting him play with that strong grip. And I said, well, that's a good matchup for his club delivery and the way he uses his lower body. So anyway, it's hard to explain that to people in a general conversation, but golf's such a cool game because, you know, if you look at the Hall of Fame, you're going to see different ways of holding the club, and the best of the best, you know, they've won tournaments with weak grips, strong grips, interlock, overlap, 10 finger. I mean, they're guys across the line, laid off, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. And Kyle's golf swing, you know, it's evolved and it continues to evolve, but we had to work off some things that he had been doing naturally as an athlete. And if you can imagine the way a baseball player looks when they hit a home run, well, he had some of those characteristics in his golf swing, but to his credit, he didn't mix up those hitting planes. So he was a good ball striker. As he got bigger, stronger, he got exponentially longer. And thankfully, you know, the way we trained and developed his shot making, we didn't disturb that action. You know, sure. It'd been easy to ruin him, to be honest. If I taught him conventionally, you guys wouldn't know who he is. He wouldn't be doing what he's doing. I would have ruined him if I gave him a normal grip. I was just fortunate enough to realize, don't get caught up with how it looks. Watch what the ball is doing. Can he hit shots with this? He's taught me more about golf than I've taught him about golf.
Really?
And I can say that with a lot of good players. And look, he asked some incredible questions that have made me go out and learn things. And he's a great student, very inquisitive. But the main thing is with someone like Kyle or any, you know, special player of that caliber is you got to understand how they deliver the club. And then you got to understand with their body, how they generate force over that amount of time in the swing. So, you know, when people hear the word power, you're starting to think about how much effort you put into something, right? But it's a golf swing, you got about 3/4 of a second to put your power into the swing. That's it. And some players use a longer backswing to do it. Some use a shorter backswing to do it. Some set their wrists early, some set them late. But once you figure out the sequence for a player and you tune it, then some pretty cool things can happen. I just worked with a junior before we got on this podcast who 15 yards longer on his irons today. I've never seen him before. He lives around the corner from me, and it was unbelievable. Now, I don't get that result with everybody, but he had such an obvious power leak that we cleaned up, and he's a good player. He's a 3 handicap, and he's going to get better and better, but he was definitely missing out on something that not only helped him hit it longer, but much better club path delivery and so forth. But, you know, what's unique about Kyle is, again, he's able to generate tremendous force and deliver it in a timely fashion. He hits the center of the face more than most. That's why he dominates long drive competitions when he competes, because there might be some guys that can be close to his club speed, but they don't strike the center of the face nearly as often. And that's from him, number one, being really good at hitting the center of the face before he was a long driver. And number two, handling that speed. Not everybody can handle that speed and deliver it. So, you know, as a player, he became a very good ball striker in high school. Didn't score particularly well because of some deficiencies on wedge play and putting, but he's gotten better at those, and he loves the game, and he's been fun to work with.
At what age did he start out driving everybody, or significantly, or where like even becoming a long driver would become a reality?
There's a funny phone call I received. This is back, I'm going to say, let me just do a little math here, about 12 years ago. And I'm teaching at Caves, and I get this call from this guy. He's left me three voicemails in literally a 90-minute period. He's desperate to talk to me. He had just played with Kyle at the U.S. Amateur Qualifying at Woodhome Country Club, where I used to teach. And he said to me in the voicemail in so many ways, I need to come see you. I've never played with someone who's outdriven me, much less by, you know, on top of that, 40 yards at times. He was so blown away by how far Kyle was hitting it. And this guy was a good player. And he's off to play college golf in like 3-4 months. But that was starting to happen.
You know, did you take him as a student?
I did. You know, we spent time. Great guy. But long story short, you know, people were getting blown away right around that time frame when he was, you know, playing his junior year of just after, you know, junior year, that summer right before his senior year, he was doing stuff with the golf ball that no one could do, you know, and just absolutely smashing it. Now, didn't score well all the time, but his ball striking was very, very memorable for people. And again, off the tee, some stuff that, you know, just no one had even close to that speed.
So let me ask you a question on, well, I'll go on both sides of generating power in the drive, but I'll start with Kyle and what does work. The first time I saw him in person, he actually came down for a little, I forgot, not a seminar, but he was just kind of did a little hitting session at Laurel Hill. He was, and the amount of turn and torque on his upper body and enabling him to bring the club so far back, still maintaining a straight left arm, I just had never seen the differential between the upper torso turning and the hips kind of, or the lower body, I'm not describing it well, but just the difference. I had never seen someone turn like that in my life. And I asked him afterwards, you know, what his secret was, and he just said, you know, I stretch a lot.
Well, yeah, maybe his secret is genetics, right? And it's not from his dad. His dad's gonna laugh if he hears this podcast. But his mom, if you meet his family, you'll see what I'm talking about. But he's mobile, but, you know, surprisingly, he does have some areas where he's not super mobile. But the reason I say that to you, like, being the most flexible person is not an advantage. You're like a strip bolt. You have to have something to torque, right? And Kyle, you know, like I mentioned, he's double jointed, right? So if he puts his arms out like in a wingspan test, probably can't see me, but his forearms sit below his elbows.
Oh, interesting.
That's a unique quality, right? And what does that do? It lets him build a huge arc.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean you can't play golf with a bent left arm as a right-handed player. There's some long hitters. They're long drivers that bend their arms. But he's doing what works for him. And what you have to understand, to be powerful, to be efficient with your golf swing, you better have the right matchups. And that's what a good coach can help you with. And sometimes, you know, you might be working on something that looks pretty, but it doesn't really deliver the goods. And then, you know, might not like the look of your swing and you're hitting it well. It could be because you're more efficient within that type of motion. So you have to make sure you're doing the right things for your body and for your ball flight. But Kyle understands things, and he's a race car driver. He understands all the controls. He knows where to adjust things. He's an expert at making some very subtle adjustments that very few people know he's doing. And, you know, big thing we have to do is be able to shift gears, you know, from power to finesse. So we have different tactics to take speed off and different tactics to help him control his distance better. But there's very few people on the planet that can go as fast as him. I think we could count him on one hand, but his ultimate advantage, he understands golf at a higher level than his competition, and he strikes it in the middle of the face more than most.
You mentioned how the junior that just added 15 yards that you just saw today, you know, and they had a pretty significant power leak going on. You know, what is the most or a couple of the most common power leaks that you see, especially when you see a new student or just an amateur that's not maximizing their potential? Is there something common?
Well, it depends, right? If they're mishitting the golf ball, then we have to get them hitting the golf ball more solid before we add speed. You know, it's pointless to add speed if you're not striking the face correctly. Sure. You're just going to, it won't make any difference. So, you know, unfortunately, like you can stand there, and I'm sure some of your listeners have tried over speed training, which can be very helpful. But at the same time, if your impact point gets less consistent and it gets worse, it didn't really help you, right? All it did is made you mishit worse with the club going faster. But if we can deliver the club face to the ball and strike it properly for the shot at hand. So if you're hitting a driver and you're good at delivering that face to the ball when it's teed up, that's a big deal. Not everybody's good at delivering the club face to a ball on a tee. Some are better at hitting the golf ball when it's on the ground. Or, you know, maybe they're good at catching the ball on a tee, but they don't do well on the ground. So we got to tune your strike. If you're striking it pretty solid, which this junior was, and again, you know, his message to me was, I'm struggling a little bit with, he was hitting kind of a pull cut. And then he said, with my driver, I'm hitting this low left shot. I said, all right, you know, let me watch you. And we looked at a few things. I made an adjustment to improve his club delivery so he wouldn't hit those shots. But the beautiful thing about that adjustment, when I looked at it, I was like, man, this is going to be at least a club more in distance for him, because it was so flagrant what he wasn't doing. And so when I see that in a player, and I get a, you know, it's kind of like I get a two for one. I help the impact, but I also help them be more efficient with what they're doing. Those are incredible moments for the coach and the player. But sometimes it's literally just getting better contact for a player. You know, they might be going within what they can do speed-wise. When you start pushing speed, just understand you got to make sure your strike is with it. If you're going faster and mishitting, it doesn't really help. But usually what we can do once I watch someone hit and see how they move and check them with a few movement screens I do, I'll pick up on where we can add some power without compromising consistency at impact. And, you know, at the same time, if you're moving well and things are going reasonably well, sometimes it's equipment. Sometimes we just need to modify what you're playing. But a lot of times people's sequences aren't very efficient. And when I say that, it could be a concept or it could be a misconception. And so that's where you might have to go slow to ultimately go faster. So you might have to do some slow-mo swings where you learn the correct sequence. So even though you're trying to go faster or be more efficient with your power transfer, you have to go back almost like into a martial arts mode where you do things slowly to feel and build the correct sequence, and then you can add some speed to it. So main thing is we want to always deliver that club where you can strike it solid. Okay, if we check that box, then as we start figuring out what works for you, if you're a rotary player, how do we help you with that? If you're someone that uses more lateral force, how do we help you with that? If you're someone that doesn't move very well, how can we get your arms to go faster? we might have to close your stance a bunch to give you some kind of pivot in the backswing because you just don't have the range of motion. Or maybe you got too much range of motion. We might have to do something else. So there are a lot of things to...
A lot of ways to skin the cat.
Tweak it. Yes.
Sure. What about, so the three phases of the game in the title of the book, speed, power, finesse. The average amateur might look at, especially the first two, and say speed and power. Those sound pretty similar to me. Break down the difference between speed and power.
Yeah. So speed is the easiest way to think about it is either how fast the club's moving when it hits the ball.
Okay.
Or how fast the ball is leaving the club face. So you have club speed and ball speed. When someone hits a driver, we'll use some round numbers to make it easy for everybody to do the math here. If you swing a driver at 100 miles an hour and your ball leaves at 150 miles per hour, 150 miles an hour ball speed, that's a 1.5 smash factor. You'll hear that industry term, and that's telling you the relationship of the club and the ball speed. So the ball left 1.5 times faster than the club hit the ball. But if you go by the green and you hit some short game shots and you're swinging at 20 miles an hour, I hope that your chip or your pitch shot isn't leaving 1.5 times faster than your club speed because you will be terrible around the green. You're sculling it or, you know, you're just not hitting it correctly because what you want around the green is actually to minimize the smash. You want the ball coming off softer. So the techniques we use for power transfer on the driver is very, very different for short game shots. And ultimately, speed comes in different components. You know, like when you hear the word speed on the putting green, you're talking about how well someone rolls the ball for the distance of the putt. If you're not good at controlling your speed, you got no chance to be a good putter. You're just going to make too many three putts or worse. So to me, speed is not just one thing. Now, the amount of speed I generate for a shot has a lot to do with the power I put into the golf club from my body, right? So we make a backswing, whether you're putting or taking a driver swing, to produce a distance. So if you have a 10-foot putt, you don't take the putter back super far. If you have a 40-foot putt, I hope you take the putter back further than a 10-foot putt. And, you know, that's a good way to think about it. You're going to use a little more stroke to make the ball go further. If you don't, you're going to have to blast it with a lot of acceleration, which you might get lucky and pull off here and there, but it's pretty hard. But on your driver swing, if you're going for power, you're probably doing some things a little different than if you're hitting, let's say, an off-speed wedge shot, you know, a non-full wedge shot or a greenside pitch. So we're always trying to organize a swing so it produces the shot at hand. And to do that, you got to understand that relationship. So for speed, okay, what's the speed goal for this shot? Am I trying to get this club to go as fast as possible and deliver a club face that's strong? Okay, that means I'm hitting driver.
Sure.
I might use a lot of speed by the green to hit a finesse shot where I go right under the ball and hit a high, soft pitch shot or a bunker shot. So there's different reasons we go fast, but then how do we take speed off? So that's all part of it. So what you'll see in golf, and this is not uncommon, even on the PGA Tour, there are players that are driving it great. Their finesse shots aren't that good that week. But when they couple them together, wow, they can play some great golf. Look at Rory McIlroy at the Masters this year. He finally dialed in his wedge play, controlled his distances beautifully. He's always driven the ball great. Yeah. He was a little bit off with his driver, but man, did he hit some incredible recovery shots. And his wedge game, yeah, he might have mishit one on 13, but you know what? He hit so many good short irons that week, controlled his distances, and he does a lot of the time, but under severe pressure. His superpower is that driver, and his Achilles heel has always been probably his wedges. The man that did it the best, Tiger Woods, tee to green. I mean, during his heyday, wow, what a complete player. Super long, incredible wedge player, great long iron player, you name it. Nicklaus, incredible putter, great driver of the ball, incredible iron player. Didn't really have to hit the wedge shots the way the guys have to today. Not that he was a bad wedge player, but you know, Tiger had it all there for for a good bit of time. And you're seeing it with Scotty now. Scotty, if you look at Scotty's game, he's in the top 20 in putting. Mm-hmm. That's crazy to think because he's got everybody beat on ball striking, got a great mindset. So my book is helping people understand those differences and what they can do to improve in those areas. And more importantly, understand why what they're doing might work really well in one part of the bag and it doesn't work in the other part of the bag. You know, so you could be driving it great and you're not hitting your wedges well. You could be hitting your wedges well and not be able to hit the driver or some combination of that. So I just wanted to give people a sense of, look, this is what, to me, golf's a combination of many shots. Here's some ways to think about it. Here are some ways to get better in these areas. And here are some ways to understand how to practice and build these skills. Because ultimately, if you can play those three games, you're going to play some really good golf.
Love it. And this is actually your second book. I know that because I have your first one right here.
There you go.
Years ago, the game, you. Enjoying golf on and off the course. I read a good bit of this when I think about maybe 3 or 4 years ago. But this kind of touches on all aspects of the game, including the last chapter I actually really enjoyed. It was just like how to enjoy the game more, both on and off the course. I think it was the chapter. But it tells you everything from hosting guests to being a guest to, you know, a little bit of the mental game, a little bit of everything. But is it fair to say that this new book kind of just takes everything that you've learned as a coach and try to put it into the written word? And I don't have your new book yet. I do plan to get it. But are there pictures in there? Like how is it helping the?
Oh yeah,
the golf.
Yeah, this is a totally different. I'll hold it up so you can see it here. Oh, there's the cover. Inside, you'll see lots of, it'll look like you're reading a big golf digest.
There you go. Okay.
So we have, it's 8.5 by 11, lots of pictures, lots of swing sequences that you'll see some of the players I've shot over the years at tour events. Kyle's in here with his long drive swing, short game shots, all kinds of stuff, some cool equipment stuff. The whole idea behind that book is more about giving people an overview of how to do these things better. And ultimately, what I like to do when I coach players is, first of all, like, how can I help you today? You know, what do you need help with? Direct them accordingly. Now, sometimes they're going to look for my advice on what they should work on. So we'll assess their game and what have you. But now, if someone came to me and all they want to do is improve their wedge game, well, there's some stuff in here to help with that. If they want to improve their mindset, there's stuff in there to help them with that part of the game. They want to get better at off-speed shots. So, I mean, you're never going to cover everything in a book, but there's a lot of good stuff in there. And this is more how-to, where the game, the book that you have, there's certainly recommendations on how to do things, but it's also a conversation about how to enjoy the game more. And these are things that you can do to get better. First of all, like, in my first book, I tell you how to evaluate your game, you know, how to understand your game, because you could be a 15 handicap or a 5 handicap and have the same skills on the putting green. But at the end of the day, your score lines up differently. But, you know, we're not all defined the same way as golfers. You know, they're players that, man, you watch them strike the ball and they tell you, I'm a 7 handicap. You're like, gosh, what are you doing around the greens? Oh, yeah, I can't. They can't get off the tee or whatever it might be. So once you understand your game, you have a lot better chance of getting to where you're going if you have a goal for performance. And your goal might be, look, I just want to have more fun playing with my kids or my spouse or my friends. And that's fine. This isn't all about becoming a tour player or a junior champion. But more than anything, it's nice to know what to work on and have a game plan. So that's what these are designed for. And, you know, the more intimate instruction is always in person. And, you know, more than anything, you know, when you do what I do for a living, you try to figure out ways to tell your story in different parts of the game and different parts of your career. So that's why I have them out there.
Love it. We got the game, enjoying golf on and off the course, and speed, power, and finesse, both available on your website, BernieNajjar.com. And certainly I saw them on Amazon as well, I believe, right?
Yes, they're on Amazon.com. And now if you go to my site and you want to get a signed copy, that's the way to go. But you can order it off Amazon and and have it in a day or two. But, you know, the main thing with these books and what I tell everybody is realize these are guides. They're absolutes for you to do everything I have in there. They're to give you some direction. Ultimately, you need to work with a coach that leads you properly through the things that you're working on. And I know if you do that and have fun doing it, you're going to get better at golf.
Certainly. Well, I'll get you out of here on this. And this is almost, this is backing up in the conversation. But as we're talking, I'm kind of thinking about other stuff that you've brought up. But, you know, as the coach of the longest hitter of the golf ball on the planet, you mentioned, you know, Bryson chatted with you for 90 minutes on the driving range, trying to figure out how to hit the ball longer, or at least having conversations around it. You know, I imagine having him as a client has helped your business, but are there, you know, do you get calls from tour players or high level players, you know, whether it's mini tours or high level college golfers that are specifically like, I saw you coach Kyle. I need an extra 10 yards.
You know, I would say this to you. I definitely have been fortunate to have Kyle as a student, and, you know, Bryson's curiosity and everybody's curiosity is always going to be like, tell me a little bit about what he's doing. You know, they're not necessarily trying to do it for themselves, but they just want to understand where they might stack up to things. But I think what's really relevant is people that are fascinated with golf, whether they're tour players or recreational golfers, they love watching Kyle Berkshire hit a golf ball, whether it's in person or on a YouTube video. He's captured a huge audience and people are interested in that. I would say that tour players, when they reach out, most of them are curious about their game. They're not comparing their game to someone else's per se. Sure. They might have a sequence issue where they're trying to fix a ground force scenario when they're on force plates. They notice some things, so they might want to ask about that, but not necessarily relative to Kyle, just, hey, struggling with this component here, or
right,
could be something else. But there's some great coaches out there that are with most of these guys week in, week out. And a lot of them are my friends. And, you know, there are times where they might reach out and ask me for some advice on some things they're trying to do. And, you know, you can't wear all the hats in golf as a coach. But I think what's really important is understand everybody out there who's grinding away, working at it. They're curious. And they also know, like, hey, this is what I do. I'm not going to do these things. That doesn't go with my golf swing. So I'll leave you with this. Matt Kuchar came in with his coach back in, I'm going to get my years wrong, but we'll say 2015-ish, 2016-ish. And we did a little work on my force plates to help him see what he was doing. And, you know, he pretty much said, look, I'm open to anything to help me hit it longer, but the ball can't go left. I fade my shots. I never want to see a straight ball. I never want to see a ball go left. I will not do any of this. And what you have to understand about Matt, especially at that point in time, he was top 20 virtually every time he teed off. He had just come in off the Presidents Cup win, and what a phenomenal player. Tremendous ball control, tee to green. You're not going to have him do these power moves, even if he can do them, because he's not going to give up the ball flight control. But he's curious and he wants to see relative to what he does, what he can do. And that's what you have to understand. Like the highest level players, they're not going to risk some of these extreme maneuvers. Sure. And again, going back to extreme maneuvers, that's not what these books or ideas are all about. They're about helping you understand what you need to do and realize your body is moving the way it's moving. You got to know your body swing connection and understand how things work. But if you're an explosive player and you can do some of the things that might look like what Kyle does, Bryson doesn't swing like Kyle. His right foot's almost on the ground at impact. They're very different, right?
Their swings don't look anything alike.
Yeah. But there are things going on that they're all doing very well and they're very efficient. And that's what it comes down to. And, you know, what I'll leave you with is that doesn't matter if you're a tour player, recreational golfer, you usually can find something to get better with the right kind of training. But don't waste your time chasing things that don't match. and be real smart about how you spend your time. You know, what I'll leave everyone with, you got 10 hours to practice, 6 to 7, please spend inside 100 yards. Don't do it the other way.
Nobody actually applies that, but yes, I need to do some of that myself. Well, all right, Bernie, this has been great. I know we went over time a little bit, so I appreciate it very much, but I hope you have this will probably come out early of BMW week. So I hope you have a great time and your time up there this week. And I hope Caves is a great tournament. I'm sure they will.
Thanks so much, Alex. Great being with you.